Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 30172, Noah B. Queens Medical Center. Arguing for the petitioners, John S. Edmonds. Also appearing for the petitioners, Joy S. Omonaka and Michael J. Y. Young. Arguing for the respondents, Edmund Burke and John Burke. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. For both sides, are you ready to proceed? Mr. Edmonds? Mr. Burke, all right. Mr. Edmonds, I understand you wanted to be warned with reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, so the warning light will come on with 10 minutes to go in your argument to let you know you've reached that point. Now, Mr. Burke, I understand that you were going to split the argument in some way. That's an unusual procedure in this court, but since that's how you prepared the argument and Mr. Edmonds doesn't object, you may proceed first, but then we won't be having switching back and forth between you. So at some point, after your shift is done, you can turn it over to John Burke and he can wrap up. But you'll be leading off, is my understanding. Okay, and then we'll be warning you with a light with 10 minutes to go. Very well. Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Edmonds, if you would proceed.
Associate Justices, if it pleases the court, there is a very brief presentation I can make, but it will then broaden out into a broader, more ranging presentation. It's not clear to appellants the basis on which this court granted certiorari. We're obviously glad that you did. It may have been on a narrow point, and that is, we are here, of course, under a de novo review standard, and because you are reviewing what happened in the trial court below de novo, we look at whether indulging every reasonable inference, well, first, taking the facts as alleged by the plaintiff, the moving party, and discarding or putting aside all of the facts alleged by the non-moving party and indulging every reasonable inference in favor of the moving party, can this court say that no reasonable jury could have found in our favor? And it seems to me that's a very simple answer, because given testimony about all the various risks, given the paramount fact that the defendant failed totally to comply with the statute, except to tell the parents he was going to give a medication and identifying the medication, and it was to be IV, and later sending him home with tablets. He failed totally to comply with the statute. In that respect, this case, I submit, is very different from any of the other informed consent cases that have come before the court. There is one, I believe, where no warnings were given. But what?
Well, one question is whether there was sufficient expert testimony with regard to materiality of risk. That seemed to be a problem for the trial court and the ICA basically backed up the trial court on that issue. So that would be, is that, what's your view? Was there sufficient expert testimony or not? And if so, why?
It was sufficient. I was frankly amazed to read that by the Intermediate Court of Appeals. For example, our key witness on materiality was Dr. Towley. And Judge Kim criticized Dr. Towley for the way in which he answered a particular question. He was asked, would you prescribe this under the circumstances? What should they have been told? And his answer was quite candid. He said, I wouldn't have told them anything because I never would have gotten to that step. He didn't fill this in. He didn't say, because nobody in their right mind would give this when you had Zofran available or some of these other drugs. He didn't say it that way. He just said, I would never use this drug. Now, the reason I let off by talking about the indulging of all reasonable inferences from the facts in favor of the moving party. Well, we weren't the moving party when they moved for judgment as a matter of law. We were the non-moving party, but in any event, we're the ones who were entitled to have all reasonable inferences drawn in our favor. And when a physician gets up and says, I wouldn't get to step two about telling him what the risks are because I can't conceive under these circumstances, his phrase, under these circumstances, I would never use this drug. What is the reasonable inference that's to be indulged? That it's not safe, that there are risks.
Well, actually, Dr. Tal did, despite so testifying. You know, in our cases, we have said that we ordinarily require, in terms of materiality, we ordinarily require expert testimony on four things: nature of the risks, probability of therapeutic success, frequency of occurrence, and the nature of available remedies. And in this case, the ICA said expert testimony was not adduced as to the second and the third, which is the probability of therapeutic success and the frequency of occurrence, and therefore this there's a failure. However, we have said ordinarily, right?
Yes.
And in the ICA seems to be saying that the plaintiff had the burden of showing the probability of therapeutic success of the Reglan.
Yes.
And didn't your experts testify that, at least it seems that it hasn't been tested or it hasn't been sufficiently tested for pediatric use?
Well, yes and no. Our expert said, I was just trying to deal with this one point because it seemed to trouble Judge Kim that our expert couldn't even get to step two. But I was arguing indulging the reasonable inference would be you don't give it because it's far too dangerous. Now,
is the upshot of that decision by Judge Kim and the ICA means that if you give something off-label and it hasn't been approved, then informed consent, you can never violate. That seems to be...
No, not necessarily. And that gets to the second point I want to raise. If I may, Justice McKenna, for just a moment. The ICA criticized us on the package insert issue, and they said that package insert standing alone would never be sufficient, or was not sufficient in this case. But we didn't argue package insert alone. We put on evidence of what was on the package insert, and we had expert testimony saying, in conjunction with the package insert, saying, that's among the reasons why I don't use it. That you have what the package insert says, and I think it was either Dr. Gallup, who testified about all the problems that one has with it. So we come within the decision in Nakapui versus DACANAY, which the Hawaii Supreme Court decided 42908. I thought it was the ICA, frankly. But it's Nakapui versus DACANAY, which says that the contents of the package insert is relevant, it is admissible, obviously was admitted here, on the question of the materiality of various risks, if one has an expert testifying in conjunction with that, and we did. So in that sense, the ICA was wrong.
No, I think, Mr. Edmonds, you may have misunderstood, or my question wasn't clear. No, my point is just that how can you show something doesn't have a probability, or what the probability of therapeutic success if you're prescribing it for a use that hasn't been approved, that there's no studies. That's what I mean. Their analysis seems to take one out of the whole informed consent proposition. In other words, a doctor can prescribe something off-label with no test, no study, and be relieved of advising the patient.
Well, I would come back to the way Justice McKenna led in. She talked about ordinarily being the predicate, ordinarily.
Right, so the question is, how can you establish this if it hasn't even been approved for this purpose, and it hasn't been tested for this purpose?
And if you can't, that doesn't...
Isn't that what this court has said, ordinarily?
Ordinarily. But if you can't, nonetheless, that's recognized, and there it becomes a jury question. Another legal rationale for reaching that same result, both the one Justice Pollack talked about and the one you talked about, is this. This is a defendant who flouted the mandate of the statute. One of the things that troubled me about what the ICA did when I got the decision is they jumped right in and started criticizing the plaintiff and our failure of proof. Not a word about a physician who did not comply with the mandate of the statute. Didn't do any of it. Now, why not? And if he didn't, does one call it estoppel, waiver, or simply we don't get to any of these questions because he didn't do his job? And the ICA said nothing about that. In other words, the only analogy I could come up with would be contributory negligence, or in the old days, last clear chance, where the plaintiff alleges negligence, defendant sets up last clear chance for contributor. The one goes to trial. If the defendant elects not to put on any evidence of contributory negligence, fine, he's waived it. Here it's a little more complicated because the statute mandates that the defendant physician do certain things. If it's an informed consent case, which Judge Kim said it wasn't, I don't understand that, but that's what he said. It was pled. If it's an informed consent case, at that point, we obviously have to prove certain things, but the physician must, by statute, come forward, and he doesn't come forward. Now, having not come forward, having not even talked about the risks, not one of them, I'm not sure he knew them because he frankly admitted he wasn't trained in the use of this drug, but all right, he used it a lot, but wasn't trained in the use of it. Having not done that, that being step one, the physician is, it's a well-pled allegation of failure of informed consent. The physician doesn't meet the statutory mandate. Why are we suddenly jumping to step five or four where the trial court comes in and says we haven't proven materiality of risk? And if the physician had met his mandate, we would have known precisely what it was we were supposed to be aiming at. In other words, he would come in, testify what the various risks were. Then we'd have a clear picture of what we were supposed to come up with. He didn't do that. We didn't have a clear picture.
It seems like the trial judge was saying that you need an expert to say that, use the buzzword material, say this was a material risk, and to say that. It appears that the law in Carver versus Strode says a risk is material when a reasonable person, in which the physician knows or should know to be the patient's position, would be likely to attach significance to the risk or cluster of risks in deciding whether or not to forego the proposed therapy. So it appears that, it's not really clear, but the law is that materiality, whether or risk is actually material, is not something that requires expert testimony. What is your position on that? In other words, because it depends on the person. A minor risk might be material to a young person, but perhaps not someone that is otherwise going to die.
My position first is that we had testimony about the materiality of risk without using that phrase. In support of that, I would urge this court, in whatever decision rendered, to remember that this court has said in a series of cases on causation, Backrand versus Morishige, the old case where this court said no particular form of words is necessary, but we have to be able to be satisfied that there is a reasonably probable link between the event and the result. You said no particular form of words is necessary.
What was the testimony that you're referring to? Is that Dr. Gallup's testimony? Because Dr.
Towley, when Towley said, I would never give this under these circumstances, he was very specific. He didn't say, I never use this drug, but he said under these circumstances.
Because it was not approved for use.
Each of the physicians who testified that they wouldn't use it or shouldn't have been used gave a much more detailed recitation. Reglan creates motility in the bowel. It loosens things up. It opens up the pyloric valve, enables fluid to run through the system more quickly, and therefore in a dehydrated person, The one thing you don't want is losing more is to lose more fluid, but that's precisely what it does, and that's what Zofran doesn't do. And there's testimony in the record about that. Both Gallup talked about that, and I believe Towley testified to it, and he explained. That's why he said under these circumstances, did injection. I'm working from his a transcript of March 9th, 2009, at page 19. Did injection of the Reglan cause or increase the amount of fluid that was in her system that was excreted out by diarrhea? Yes. Are you able to say to what degree it did that? Mild, moderate, strong? At least moderate. And did that add, you have an opinion whether that increased her dehydration?
And he says significantly.
Yes, significantly. So is that creating a material risk?
Yes. And the next question is, was this a substantial factor leading to her shock? And yes, and did that and substantially hasten the... So in a sense, when the doctor was asked why he would not give it to her, isn't the inference the risk?
Yes.
I mean, it just seems so. And then with Dr. Gallup's testimony, it would seem that the materiality of the risk is present by the testimony.
I agree, it couldn't be clearer. The other, and then we come back to the question of, given the standard of de novo review and indulging every reasonable inference from the evidence that's there, isn't there satisfaction of the materiality of risk requirement?
Didn't Judge Kim seem to partially rely on there not being any testimony that the parents would have
indeed
altered? And is that a problem? Is there a problem with that?
Not under the case I just cited and under an earlier case. Well, it's
a problem that the judge relied on it. Is that
I'm sorry, I just didn't.
Is there a problem that the judge relied on that?
Yes, because both in Nakapui is the package insert case. It's Bernard versus Char, where this court adopted the objective plaintiff standard. Where three views. There's the subjective plaintiff, the mixed, and the objective. And this court said that it was going to adopt the objective plaintiff and said that under that standard, the plaintiff often need not testify. In fact, the court said, since it's what an objective plaintiff would have expected, and since any plaintiff who, they actually talked about going to the trouble of coming to court and finding an attorney who would take it, they said, at least they didn't say it was unbelievable, but they said by the time a plaintiff gets to court on an informed consent case, obviously he or she is going to testify that if the risks had been explained, they wouldn't have had the procedure. So we assume that's going to come up in every case. Anyone who was going to testify to the contrary isn't going to be a plaintiff in an informed consent case. So they said, for all those reasons, we're not going to require that the plaintiff testify. Now, the court did require, or suggest at least, that there be some evidence from which the court could infer, the trial court could infer, that the plaintiff would not have consented. And although this is not a trial court and you're not a jury, that evidence is there. There is not a person in this room who has a child or who doesn't, who, if the risk of Zofran and Reglan had been laid out side by side by this doctor and had been told, FDA hasn't approved this one, but they've approved this one. With Reglan, we have an increase in fluid leaving your daughter's body, but she's dehydrated and we shouldn't have fluid leaving her body. No parent in their right mind, no non-parent who's a bystander, no one would say, go ahead and use that medication.
Well, what about the argument that the evidence didn't suggest Zofran was available at the hospital? I believe defendants raised that argument.
Yes. Zofran is available by prescription at any pharmacy in the state. It was a disingenuous statement. I mean, he just said, and he didn't say it wasn't available. His testimony was, I wasn't clear that it was available to me. It's not a very good reason for not using it, but again, he had a duty to warn under the statute. The duty to warn doesn't say, oh, if the hospital doesn't happen to have it in stock and it's readily available, you don't need to mention that. He had a duty to go through what the risks were of what he was doing and to offer alternatives. One might have been, we'll keep her here, we'll keep putting saline in, we'll monitor her, and I'll send a nurse out to get her. I've seen orthopedic surgeons stop what they're doing, freeze things when a hip implant piece is not correct, and send out across town to another hospital.
Mr. Edmonds, actually, wasn't his testimony, he said he knew that there was a drug out there,
yes,
which means maybe it was in the next room or down the hall, but he did not use it because in his memory, it wasn't available to me to use.
Yeah, that's what he, not available to me to use. I don't know what that means, but I know that it's a prescription drug that all the pharmacies carry. So it was, yes, there was testimony. Is it reliable, credible? Again, is he entitled to say something like that where he has not met the statutory mandate? Now, I said earlier that there was a shorter and factually intensive part of the presentation I wanted to make, but now we broaden out, because what result where a physician fails to follow the mandate, every bit of the statutory mandate, and he just didn't even do the basics, what result? Is he going to be heard to, do you ever get to testimony like that? Or do you have an obligation to warn of the risks? I think one reasonable inference is he didn't know what the risks were of Breitling. Another reasonable inference was that he didn't know what this drug that he wasn't so sure was available to him was.
Well, he did say he was aware that the manufacturer had indicated that the safety and effectiveness of Breitling in pediatric patients was not established.
Not established. Again, though, because we have had expert testimony in combination with the package inserts, you take the package insert plus the expert testimony, that should be sufficient. To say that the safety has not yet been established as compared to a drug which has been established, if you're a parent and you're there with a sick child, which one are you going to pick? What's the reasonable inference? And on that basis, it should belong to the jury.
The insert specifically said not to extrapolate, right?
Pardon me?
The insert, yes.
It said the use cannot be extrapolated to children. And that's what I believe Dr. Tolley said. He said you can't take the decision was quite heavy. So you can't take a 9-year-old overweight child and compare that child to an adult of the same weight. You can't do it. That's what non-extrapolation means. He didn't know, frankly, what he was doing. It's just something he tried. Now, I wanted to mention another point because it's a fact-intensive point. Mr. Chief Justice, I'm cutting in my rebuttal time, and I realize that, but I
assume if you have something you think is important, wrap it up, and then we can please present it, and then we can move on to the.
There was evidence in the record that the mother did not report to the hospital when her daughter had to go into the bathroom and both vomit and pass diarrhea. That's undisputed. But what would have happened if the doctor had met the mandate of the statute and said to them, we were giving her Raglan IV, it can increase her tendency to have diarrhea? Isn't it a fair inference that she was entitled to have that knowledge? If she'd had that knowledge when she went into the bathroom, many of us have raised children, and children have diarrhea, we don't per se think it's terribly unusual, but it was very unusual here. It was a sign that that medicine was causing more dehydration. Ms. Wynn didn't know that because he breached his mandated obligation to disclose to her what this drug did and how it functioned, but he didn't do that. So before she left the hospital, he would have been on notice if he followed the mandate that it was already trouble. Now, you call that negligence, failure of informed consent, approximate result of the failure of informed consent, it's something that cries out for a remedy. The other thing I'd focus on is when we talk about materiality of risk, it would obviously be helpful to the practicing bar, and I think to this court, to have a working definition. And it's very dangerous to get down the percentage road, I need to suggest. The risk of death from a just by way of example, the risk of death from a general anesthetic in a healthy 25 to 40-year-old male, female, assuming you go into the hospital and they've got to give you a general anesthetic, and there's nothing otherwise wrong with you, you're going in for some kind of elective surgery, plastic surgery, they've got to give you a general. That risk is it's probably judicially noticeable at between 1 in 300,000 down to 1 in 100,000. Now, if you work that out on a percentage basis, it's such a small percentage it approaches zero. But every court that's ever looked at the risk of death from general anesthetic says it has to be warned about. Now, that's a material risk, but you can't resolve it by talking about percentages. It's a very real risk of death, and if somebody isn't warned about it, and they always are not, it's on the informed consent forms, and doctors go over it, but it's everybody understands it, patients understand it. But that highlights the danger in trying to come up with a quantification of what a material risk is.
Mr. Edmonds, do you have any response to the defendant's argument that you've waived the requirements of 671.3.4 by not having argued this before, about the duty to advise of alternative treatments?
The response is that the judge dropped this on us out of the blue. He granted their motion so quickly and announced that it was not an informed consent case. I was proving along what we needed to. We didn't waive a thing. We put in the elements of proof. If this had come up on jury instruction, it would have been an entirely different matter. It's also plain error of the worst kind or the most egregious kind.
Didn't the judge reference the statute?
He did. Yeah, that's what we're talking about. But my point is, I don't think we waived it. I think we addressed it. But he said this isn't an informed consent case.
Well, you actually presented evidence of the availability of Zofran.
Yes.
And the defendant himself admitted that he knew of Zofran, right?
Yes. He'd heard of it.
He'd heard of it.
But I don't think it's a waiver, Justice Nakayama, to be putting on your proof of the elements of lack of informed consent and then have the court interrupt and say this is not an informed consent case. I don't think that's a waiver. We got as far as we could, and I think we met all the elements. Again, when you retire to consider this case, please ask yourselves, what do we do with the fact he did not comply with the statutory mandate? Probably wouldn't be here. And probably, if he warned, this young lady would not be here, and we wouldn't have to have been here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Burr.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and members of the court. The one thing we seem to be forgetting is really the idea that the plaintiffs have the burden of proving, in this case, the materiality of the risks. And those risks now have been listed in Carr versus Stroh, Bernard versus Char, and basically include such items as the nature of the risk inherent in a particular treatment, the probabilities of therapeutic success, the frequency of occurrence of a particular risk, and the nature of available alternatives. The Intermediate Court of Appeals found that the probabilities of therapeutic success and the frequency of occurrence of a particular risk there was not evidence produced to show that.
We have said ordinarily, and in this case, the ICA did say that Dr. Tal did not sufficiently elaborate on the probabilities that Reglan treatment would be successful and thus did not meet one element of the material, the four general prongs of materiality as we've outlined it. Our case law has also said that this type of testimony can come from anyone, correct? Even from the defendant himself. Didn't your client testify as to his usage of the prior emergency room he had been in and the usage of Reglan in many cases?
He actually testified at great length about during his training back in Brooklyn that Reglan was the medication of choice. And he had a lot of experience using Reglan and no experience as far as harm being caused by Redmond. He thought it was very good, and basically that's probably better evidence of the lack of harm from Redmond.
But that is actually dealing with the issue of standard of care, correct? But in any event, we have said that that kind of testimony can come from anyone, and we had your client testifying as to that.
Well, I think it mainly has to come from a medical expert.
Well, I think our cases do say that it can come from the defense or the plaintiff. And in fact, I also think that Dr. Ritson provided testimony. He gave all this anecdotal experience where he said, oh, we use it here and there, and then he referenced clinical trials and things of that nature, although clinical trials, he didn't introduce any studies or anything. He said clinical trials, but it's unclear whether that included children. But it seems to me there was evidence from both sides, and that's what seems like it was in the jury's hands, or should have been.
And assuming that this type of testimony would be necessary in this type of case, in terms of the frequency of the occurrence of particular risks, how would plaintiffs be able to present testimony if there have been no peer-reviewed studies using a certain medication for that purpose and under those circumstances?
I think just the usage of this medication and discussions among physicians would fit that bill. In other words, it's nothing that's just swept under the rug, so to speak.
Mr. Burke, if you go to the doctor and the doctor says, I want to give your wife thalidomide, and you say, oh, I've never heard of that. How does it go? He goes, I haven't had any problems with it. Is that an informed consent if the doctor says, on his experience, he has any problems with it? Does that comply with?
I think it can be because that. I think as far as off-label use.
Would you accept that from a doctor what's the history of this drug? I've never heard of, and the doctor says, I've never had any problems with that. Would you accept that as a good enough explanation of a judge?
Well, depending on who these people are and how convincing, probably so. Because there's a lot of off-label use of various different drugs that have not been tested, let's say, for pediatric use. And at any rate, though, one of our requirements under Hawaii law for this type of thing really requires medical expert testimony in court showing that these various elements have been met.
And it's been very clear, our case law is that it can come from the defendant doctor himself.
Okay.
There's a footnote in, I think it's the Barkay case, B-A-R-C-A-I, that case. And what it says is that it says, the expert testimony also provided for the jury information that was needed to establish the materiality of the other necessary elements of an informed consent claim, such as Barkey's general condition, the benefits to be obtained from the antipsychotic medication, and common risk associated therewith, and the alternatives to its use. Seems to me testimony here satisfied all of those.
Well, I just here with the impression that was sort of came to me from the Intermediate Court of Appeals, that these two areas I pointed out were not fulfilled. At any rate, though, to carry on, the only principal liability witness in this case was Dr. Powell, and he testified that he did not state one way or the other whether Redmond caused any harm to Jenna. And that seemed to be his theme.
But Dr. Gallup clearly testified that to a reasonable degree of medical probability, it significantly increased the diarrhea, correct?
Well, I think he did use those words, but I think that we need to analyze Dr. Gallup a bit.
But I thought informed consent, it doesn't have to be the exact result as long as an adverse consequence, and I think it's clear that we have that here, and we don't confirm it. Isn't that what the premise of the informed consent is?
Well, I don't believe so. In anyway, though, Dr. Gallup we asked him whether Raveland was something that he had read about after he became an expert in this case. He's a pathologist, and he agreed that that was how he learned about Raveland. He signed on as an expert and then started reading about it in a way. And I pose to you that that's really not the...
No, Dr. Towler did say that he never would have used it in the first place, right? His was not. But in any event, that goes to standard of care, really, not as to informed consent, right?
And keep in mind, in this case, there were negligence allegations. And
you've prevailed on the standard of care issues, and that's not before this court. We're only here on the informed consent issues.
True. Now...
Do you think our expert testimony requirement is going beyond what the statute, the informed consent statute, specifically requires?
I don't think so. Now,
the current statute, we're talking about 671.3, does it require that an expert gives the requirements of B 1 through 6? Why do we need an expert?
Because that's really what Hawaii law says. If you need an expert to talk about the materiality of the risk.
But I guess what Justice Pollack was asking you was, isn't it more than what the statute requires?
Well, it's innumerable case law, and if it does go beyond the statute,
do we really need an expert when, in a situation when no information was provided?
Well, yes,
we would need it for causation,
uh-huh.
Right?
Well, and for the other elements too to go with this.
I guess the one specifically, the materiality, the risk, the statute talks about. Material risk of serious complications. This whole concept of materiality of risk, which is pretty confusing, is actually not really specifically referenced in this.
Our case law, our use of the word material in our case law does seem to conflict with the statute, which limits materiality to subsection 5. But we've actually added elements of from subsection 3 and subsection 4 in the materiality analysis. And,
I guess that's how we got there, but it's there. The materiality must be proved by an expert, medical expert with it. But if I may continue, during our argument, really, as to whether the informed consent should be dropped from this case, Mr. Edmonds indicated that the only reason we couldn't put an expert on to talk about materiality was because the expert couldn't conceive of a condition under which he would give the drug, therefore wouldn't warrant. And so we're in a situation here where Mr. Edmonds admits that not neither Dr. Tyler nor his other experts were able to talk about materiality.
Well, what would you have Dr. Tyler have said regarding 5, the recognized material risks of serious complications of the proposed treatment? when the proposed treatment isn't usually given to children? How, what would the doctor have said about, what should an expert say about that? There's been no, there have been no studies of complications of the application of that medicine to children.
But whether there are formal studies or not, something like Ritalin has been in wide use for a number of years. And so that is the basis, the results of Ritalin, which I understand are pretty much an absence of complications. This is a way of getting that.
Of the use of Ritalin with children?
Yes. Well, I think so. If my physician basically says, I have a lot of experience with this, it's an okay drug, probably so. I wanted also to focus on the comments of Judge Kim. He indicated that, in a sense, that's why there is no expert testimony on materiality, because it simply is not an informed consent case. Dr. Toll said, in answer to both Mr. Edmonds' questions and the court's questions, I can't answer that. And what he couldn't answer is the question, shouldn't the material risk of giving Ritalin be disclosed to the parents? And his response was, I can't answer that. And he goes into the reason that it should not have been given in the first place. But here is his main expert, the man that they put up to be their prime standard of care expert.
Actually, you know, this whole issue, again, is it your position that an expert has to say that this should have been disclosed to this person?
Yes.
And then how do you make Carr versus Strode, where it says a risk is material when a reasonable person would be likely to attach significance to that risk, a reasonable person in that person's perspective? And actually, when you go back and look at Canterbury versus Spence, upon which Carr versus Strode, our cases rely, and the cases cited in Canterbury versus Spence, it's very clear that expert testimony is not required on this issue. In other words, it depends on the reasonable person. Again, it could be, it's as cited by opposing counsel, it is a situation in which an objective, reasonable person needs to be provided that information. And that a jury doesn't really need to hear from an expert, does it, as to whether or not a reasonable parent of a 9-year-old would want to know whether or not his or her child who has been suffering from vomiting and continuous diarrhea, unstoppable, would want to know whether or not a medicine that is being given increases diarrhea? Isn't that something that you don't need an expert to testify to?
I still keep coming back to Hawaii law, Carr versus Strode, Bernard versus Char, and others, which do require a medical.
Actually, when we say materiality, though, materiality we have defined as four prongs. Yes. Those four prongs do not include a requirement that an expert say that this is material, use that buzzword. It says you need to provide those four items. It appears that if there's any evidence of those four items, assuming all four are required under these circumstances, because we also say ordinarily you need to provide this type of expert testimony. But if there's anything along those lines, then we are here on a judgment as a matter of law. And there's nothing in our case law saying that an expert has to say this is material, because materiality can change depending on the person. Again, if it's a young person, for example, a young mother, any risk of death, a young healthy mother on elective surgery, any risk of death may be unacceptable. But for a person at end of life that is going to die without the treatment, perhaps that might be a different reasonableness standard, reasonable person standard.
Those are factual considerations, and I quite agree with you.
Right.
But however, we are breaking our session up between my son John and I, so maybe please hear from
him. Okay, we'll hear from John Burke at this time. Thank you.
Members of the court. I would like to start actually by addressing the last question, which is, yes, there is no expert required for the standard of disclosure under Hawaii law. And answering the same question as to what's in the statute and why does it need an expert, well, look at what it's asking. The condition to be treated. You're going to have a lay person and a lay jury decide what condition is going to be treated. A description of the proposed treatment alternatives. That's why an expert is required.
Couldn't it vary depending on the circumstances?
Absolutely.
In terms of condition, there might be certain conditions that you don't need an expert.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, I have a knife wound and I'm bleeding to death.
Possibly, although I would submit it depends on what occurs, because the likely case is going to be some sort of problem with the IV or with the infection. So that's why experts bring this information to bear. I agree with the court that to the extent the information is otherwise available, and there is information in this record as to at least some of the risks, but I do need to step back. And I don't know if I'm out of line here suggesting that the court might need to consider retaining an independent expert in this case, because Zofran is not approved for the use to which it was put or which the doctor suggested it should have been put in this case. It is approved for pediatric oncology patients.
As I understood, your client didn't make any disclosure about under the statute. But, so I'm not sure what that fact that you...
His testimony was that there...
Relevant?
Excuse me, I'm sorry. What's relevant is that the court has premised several questions with, wouldn't we want to know this drug that you use wasn't approved? Well, the alternative proposed by plaintiffs also is not approved for this use.
So then both should have been disclosed.
Yes, Your Honor.
That doesn't excuse the doctor from not following the statute.
It does not excuse the doctor from not following the statute. The doctor's answer to that question is, I am not aware of the risks of Ranglin. He was aware of the manufacturer's warning of diarrhea. His own personal experience, his testimony, was that he said there was no risk. I will concede at one point that was stricken from the record. However,
if you're not aware of something, does that allow you not to follow the statute? Does the statute say you have to warn unless you don't know?
No, Justice Pollack, but what it does is it puts to the plaintiffs the burden of proof to prove the case on the other side, which is, well, what was the risk which came to pass and was it material? And as Justice McKenna has pointed out, the court's use of materiality maybe doesn't quite align with how we think of material in terms of a risk. And the use of materiality as the patient objective standard is equally troubling because, as she pointed out, what's material to the young mother may be different from the end of life. But in this case, it is not a question of you didn't tell me you were using an off-label drug. First of all, the only alternative posited was Phenergan. Phenergan by Dr. Tao. He said, I'm a Phenergan guy. I would have used Phenergan, and if that failed, I might have tried Zofran. Well, Phenergan is contraindicated for IV usage. It has a black box warning for IV injection. Separate risk, it can leach into your artery. It causes suppression of breathing problems, as does Zofran. So what I would submit is the court needs to take a look at the package inserts, which are in evidence. No drug here is approved for pediatric use. The reason, they don't do much pediatric testing. Interestingly, the clinical trial on which Dr. Towell said, this is why Zofran is safe, was a trial against Reglan. Why? Because the FDA and the relevant institutional review board or ethical panel said, yes, you may try Zofran, a new untested experimental drug against the standard of care treatment for pediatric oncology patients, Reglan.
You know, your whole argument seems to support the fact that because you're arguing the evidence in the record and our standard, can be said, the conclusion has to be is that there is no evidence to support verdict.
And
no evidence. And you're arguing both sides, so, or giving us comments on both sides, which seems to me it should have gone to the jury.
The missing evidence, I would submit, Your Honor, is precisely those four points of materiality that the court has pointed out, which is the frequency of the risk. I will concede what Dr. Towell said is, yes, they all cause this whole class, antiemetics causes diarrhea. I've read Reglan causes more. That is the risk here. That's the one. But I'm concerned because the court has posited, wouldn't a parent want to know a non-FDA drug? Well, none of these are FDA approved for this use. None of these
drugs. Why shouldn't a parent know that if all of them are non, if they're all off-label? Because obviously, some off-label drugs are supported by studies, even if they're not approved by the FDA.
And those are the studies to which you referred that Dr. Ritson testified to, and I would point out are in the evidence with the Zofran trials tested against Regula.
Is that your reason for your doctor not complying with the statute?
The doctor's compliance with the statute, I'm concerned that the court's presuming this. The question, no expert has testified that non-FDA approval is a material risk. You may interpret Toll's testimony that way if that's the case. Well,
Dr. Towler testified and Dr. Gallup testified that Reglan increases motility and increases diarrhea,
and
whereas
agree.
Zofran, one of them testified that Zofran doesn't. And so therefore, isn't that something that needs to be provided as an informed consent situation when you're dealing with a child coming in with diarrhea, severe diarrhea?
Dr. Towell's testimony was that, again, it increases it some more, an unquantifiable amount more. I will concede that. Dr. Gallup's testimony actually was going to the mechanism. He was pointing out that Reglan operates at the bottom and Zofran goes to the top. Both conceded, however, that neither cause diarrhea.
So but it increases motility. Risk. It doesn't cause diarrhea, but increases motility, which increases dehydration.
And I would also point to the factual foundation in the record here. When Dr. Towley was confronted with the family's testimony that there was no worsening of symptoms, there was no increase in diarrhea, there was no increase in vomiting, he conceded that for that reason, I can't say that this drug that should have been given, I can't say it caused harm. Dr. Gallup insisted, as you noted earlier, Justice McKenna, that in fact it significantly increased it. On cross-examination, when confronted with the family's testimony, his testimony was, I suspect it may have increased the volume. It may not have increased the frequency. I'd submit that's not an opinion to a reasonable degree of medical probability.
This is Dr. Gallup?
This is Dr. Gallup.
He was asked early on, are all of your opinions to a reasonable degree of medical probability?
He was, Your Honor. I concede that.
Thank you.
So the concern here, I understand, and the reason for the expert requirement as to materiality is not because this is what you have to say. These aren't the magic words that will get you off in a court of law. The reason is, what were the material risks of this therapy? And that is what the expert testimony is required. And I understand that the court is inclined to find that otherwise in the record. But I do submit that it should at least not be done for patently incorrect reasons, such as they would want to know. The plaintiffs succeeded here. They should have had their non-FDA drug put in front of the patient because they would want to know this other non-FDA drug with a similar risk profile wasn't approved for children. That's not the issue.
Is it non-treatment a viable treatment? I mean, administering no drugs, is that a viable treatment?
It certainly would have been within the parents' rights to a point. I don't know at what point they would have been recklessly endangering their child to have refused medical treatment when they brought her to an emergency room late in the evening.
Well, they got medical treatment. The question is whether or not the administration of drugs was necessary.
Well, all I can say is that the record is undisputed that's what the standard of care required in this circumstance. Our experts agreed that you had to provide an antiemetic, as did Dr. Powell. The question was on the identity of the antiemetic. So, to answer the question again, yes, it's within their rights to a point.
But there was in this case, all right, we're just here on the drugs. Okay.
The court has no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now we'll hear Mr. Edmonds' rebuttal.
If the doctor had done what the statute mandates, we would not, any of us, be here debating the recognized alternative treatments or procedures, what the risk of not undergoing any treatment or procedure was. We wouldn't be having to debate it. He had a burden to come forward and testify.
Did any expert testify as to any alternative other than Zofran or Phenergan?
No.
Okay. And there was no other testimony as to perhaps just not administering anything but just holding the child for a day or two and just using intravenous saline or anything like that?
Well, there was testimony that that's what they've been doing, and she'd done pretty well on that, but no expert commented on it. But again, I come back to the point Ms. Justice Nakayama asked Mr. Berg, couldn't she just have been held there and treated? And his answer...
Was that given as an alternative?
It was not, as far as I know. But if he'd done his job, if he'd done what the statute mandated, we wouldn't be worrying about that here. We would, and there would be a record. I mean, the legislature wasn't crazy when it mandated all this. And if you just think about how the trial would have unfolded, they would have put the doctor up there. He would have gone through each one of these. Then our experts would have something to come back at with and deal with. They would have agreed to subpart A or B or C, and we wouldn't be groping here for did we put on the testimony.
What about defendant's argument that none of the drugs were approved for use in children, and how does that affect the analysis?
I don't believe that the Zofran label is in evidence. I think it's only the regular. I stand to be corrected, but I was going to object to counsel's argument outside the record, certainly as to Phenergan.
But he also said something about one of them is actually approved for pediatric oncology, correct? Well, that's what he testified to. That's Zofran, actually. He testified that Zofran is approved for pediatric oncology as an anti-anemic, right?
Yeah, there was that piece of testimony. But in terms of for children, I don't believe that
we'll need to check the record.
Is in, and certainly not for Phenergan.
But just because something is approved as an anemic and not as an anti-diuretic, that might go to informed consent as to what the issues are, what a reasonable parent might want to know.
But it wouldn't help if there's no discussion in this record that is before the court about the use of the packaging for Zofran, that it's equally unknown. I don't know that as I stand here, and I don't believe it's part of this record. I think counsel's reaching outside the record. The concept of informed consent was created, was generated by the legislature after it was a court-made rule. A number of you have picked up on the distinction. I think it was Justice Pollack, that there is quite a difference between what the legislature mandated and the court-made rules that we've now seen in these various cases. And it may well be that, well, I can say it more concretely. If you look at the decision by the ICA, without commenting on the fact there was no compliance with the statute, they segue immediately into, in order to establish a claim of negligent failure to pay an informed consent, plaintiffs must demonstrate. Now, that's a judge-made rule. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with it, but it means that there should be recognition that one only gets there when the statute's complied with. When the statute is not complied with, I've said at the beginning of my argument, and it's a good place to end, I think, what result where there is no compliance with the statute? Are they entitled to come in and start talking about what's a judge-made rule? The presupposition by the ICA in other cases and by this court has been that there was compliance with the statute. Are they to be heard on the judge-made rules? To me, it's very simple. Maybe I see it too simplistically. There are certain steps they have to take. Once they've taken those steps, then they're entitled to start arguing judge-made rules, which, after all, were only there because you have the statute. Well, there were some cases that came before the statute was passed, but in the modern time here, we're talking about statute and then judge-made rules. Are we bound by judge-made rules when they don't comply with the statute? And I submit, since you have kindly granted, sir, that is hopefully one thing you'll deal with.
Very well. Anything further, Mr. Edmonds?
Just the one point that is always troublesome, and that is this issue of materiality and risk. The clinical experience of all these physicians is sprinkled throughout this record. Dr. Tori Goodman for the defense said, oh, I've used Ritalin for years, never had any trouble. You can go around the state and talk to every anesthesiologist who's practiced for 10 years, 20 years, and they'll tell you he's never had a patient die. I mean, when is the last time any of us has heard of that? It doesn't happen to healthy people. Does that mean that it's safe, that you don't need to disclose the risk? There's a trap there, and I would urge you to avoid it.
Thank you very much. Thank you to counsel for both sides. We will take this matter under advisement. Thank you.